and welcome to Backchat from Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, to listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM there in Preston, and Q Radio in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon, hello Swindon FM. You can also access the show on the internet at radioforall.net, that's the number 4-all.net.
I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm James Media.
Coming up in the show...
The corruption, the political turmoil is worse. During Saddam Hussein, life of people was much, much better. Since the collapse of Saddam Hussein, the new government of Iraq, the new government of Kurdistan, situated in Kurdistan, they do not represent people. They only represent themselves. They have created militia groups, and the system they have is based on militia.
This year marks the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. We hear from an Iraqi about life after the invasion.
The area had been extensively mined for coal and clay. There were gaping great holes in the ground, half a mile across, from which coal and clay had been extracted. And between them were the roads and the railways, and these little 24-inch gauge, 23.5-inch gauge tramways where coal and clay was hauled up out of the quarries. So this whole mess, it looked like a lunar landscape, and it was covered in a pall of smoke and dust most of the time.
Swadlin Coate remembered. Chris Waller looks back on his childhood town.
To start the show, we have part two of the debate about Europe, so over to our studio guests. Okay, now joined in the studio by Darren Jones and Colin McNamee. Darren, you're here from the Labour Party, Colin from the UKIP Party. We really want to have a chat today about the EU and obviously David Cameron making an announcement recently about the referendum of whether Britain should stay in or leave the European Union. What's your thoughts on the subject, Darren? Where do you think the UK should be? What are the benefits for the UK being in the EU?
Well, I think what's clear is that what we saw a few weeks ago was David Cameron playing party politics, not leading the country. The reason that we had this speech and the reason that he's pledged to have a referendum after the next election was merely to keep his backbench Tory MPs happy, not to act in the best interests of the country. I think it's dangerous. I think it's a gamble on the future of economic growth and the role of Britain in the world. And I was disappointed that he took the steps to do so. It shows that he was a party leader and not a good leader for our country.
I love facts. I'm a lawyer, so I don't know where you came up with the idea that I don't like facts. And I'm glad that you agree with me, Colin, that the Tories aren't very good at reforming things. We agree on that point, which is great.
Do you also agree the Labour Party aren't very good at reforming things?
I love the Labour Party. We're the progressive party providing alternative visions for our country and for the way that Europe can be involved in the world. Ed has been quite clear with his approach on One Nation Labour and the policy reviews that are going through.
But nobody listens to it. What does it mean? What does One Nation... That's as bad as Cameron's Big Society, as daft as Blair's Big Tent.
I mean, you could talk about tents if you wish, but I'm talking about the future, which again is something that UKIP doesn't seem to be doing by providing credible solutions to the way that we can move our country
forward. Control of our economy, control of our borders, and exporting where we wish, and being able to get rid of a parliament using UK democracy developed over centuries, not a failed political experiment, including the euro, the only currency in the world to be introduced without being underwritten by its issuing authority. One size doesn't fit all, and look at the mess they've made of that.
I agree with you on the euro, that it was foolish to have a difference in fiscal and monetary policy.
Oh, that's all right then, but is that the Labour policy to now agree, so that's okay, accepting that it's history? Say that to the Greeks, say that to the Irish, Portuguese. They are in serious trouble because they can no longer manage their economies. They cannot manage without the ability to control their currency.
Colin, I just said I agreed with you that there was an error in splitting monetary and fiscal policy. That's why, under the Labour government, we didn't join the euro. Actually, politically, people may have agreed with it at the time, but economically, it was the wrong thing to be doing for our country. So I'm glad that we agree on that
point. You would never have got that through Parliament, because the only of the three political parties that were in favour of the euro were the Liberal Democrats. So the Conservatives... Prior to you going in under Hague, it was a Save the Pound campaign that they successfully ran. You wouldn't have got that through the electorate. In just the same way, under Labour, you couldn't move the measurements on distance to metric, and you had to retain the pint. There's only so much the British working man will take, and it isn't losing his pint.
I can imagine. I can imagine. And you know, as nice as it is to talk about units with you, actually, the thing that I'm really interested in, and the thing that we're interested in as a Labour Party, is how can we create a future of prosperity for the British people in terms of economic opportunities, and how can we be involved within a European Union that is going to influence the world on things like climate change and other issues?
The history of the Labour Party economically is not very good. Now, climate change is not man-made. It's not man-made.
But it is a great way
of raising taxes. You know, climate change is taking place. It is not man-made. There's no proof to it. And wind turbines don't work.
I love wind turbines. Do you not think they look quite nice?
Well, you also love the Labour Party.
Maybe not in Somerset. Climate change is
taking place. There is as much proof showing that it is not man-made, and as many experts, as there are experts saying that it is. And the hockey stick graph that came out of Cambridge has been disproved as having been fixed. And it's the hockey stick graph for climate change that you're referring to if you think climate change is man-made. Rubbish, but it is a good medium for socialist parties to get taxes in.
I never referred to any hockey sticks, Colin, and actually what you're doing here is a UKIP strategy of getting people to agree with you based on the idea of unevidenced fear. And the trouble is here is that you, talking about climate change not existing... I mean,
No. I said it does exist. I said it was not man-made.
But do you agree that as a European Union, we are in a better position as a bloc to be looking at how we can tackle issues like climate change?
No, because most of the countries are ignoring it anyway. And before the European Union, there were many areas of activity, of joint activity, within member states, such as Interpol. You know, people forget that Interpol existed. The European arrest warrant is one of the most undemocratic introductions, fostered by the Liberal Democrats, supported by Labour. Interpol existed. The European arrest warrant is anti-democratic and certainly cuts right across, now I know you're not going to like this, cuts right across centuries-held belief that a person in the UK is innocent till proven guilty. It's only ourselves and Ireland work like that, not the rest of the EU, and the European arrest warrant cuts right across that.
Colin, I should clarify. I don't dislike history. I just like to find solutions to problems for the future, not just harking back on history.
A lot of those are actually in history. That's how one learns, and then you develop and you move forward. Moving forward, I do keep referring to the fact by putting the management of UK PLC back into Westminster and its accountability to the UK electorate, so that rules, laws, regulations that are introduced by Westminster come from the electorate, not from Brussels.
Here's a bit of history then. You talked about the failed concepts of the European Union. You know, Winston Churchill, his Zurich speech about peace, not war in the European Union, in Europe. Actually, that's been hugely successful. I can't remember any time we've been going to war with Germany or anyone else since that's happened. So actually, the idea about peace, not war, has been hugely successful. Now, in 2013, I agree that, you know, not in a million years would you go to war with any of our European colleagues. Let me finish. But now it's about ensuring that we have influence in the world to make sure that we can have a role in making sure that we get to where we need to on many of these issues.
Churchill's comment was to do with Europe. He did not include the UK. And if anybody is saying that the EU has brought about peace in Europe, then, like most pro-Europhiles, you seem to forget Bosnia and Kosovo. The EU didn't even get involved in those. It was the UK, it was America, and it was the United Nations. No, there has not been peace in Europe for 50 years. Don't gloss over Bosnia, don't gloss over Kosovo. And the EU was tied up with bureaucracy and did nothing.
And on Bosnia, on those two wars, Labour government, Tony Blair is Prime Minister.
The UK, the United Nations and America. It is wrong to say that the EU has held the peace in Europe. Not true.
But do you agree with me that it was a Labour government, Tony Blair as Prime Minister, that played an important role in those in resolving those issues?
I said the UK. You do. The EU has done nothing to keep the peace in Europe. And if you think peace involves the riots that you're seeing in Greece, the riots that have taken place in Spain, but not covered very well by the media, the riots that have taken place in France just recently about gay marriage, and also in Germany, the unrest in Germany is building. No, it's not kept the peace. What planet are you on, Darren? Really, it has not kept the peace.
I'm very firmly on planet Earth. I'm not quite sure where UKIP HQ is, but perhaps you might enlighten us at a later date.
Thank you. It's actually in Devon.
Is it in Devon?
Yeah, Newton Abbot.
Oh, lovely. An area that will be ravaged by climate change if it's uncontrolled.
The present housing policy of the coalition government is being driven because of immigration. The UK population, the indigenous UK population, is falling. Therefore, the number of immigrants coming in are putting pressure. Everybody talks about the benefit system and work. But in point of fact, it's putting pressure on housing. So, to overcome that, the coalition government, through Eric Pickles, has brought in a series of serious amendments to the planning laws, which are going to push development right the way through. District councils generally are on the back foot. They can no longer control the planning process, no longer control, because underlying the planning laws now is something that's been in operation for several years, but the interpretation has changed, and that is sustainable development. Now, district councils can no longer use the interpretation of sustainable development, and the villages, not only in the southwest, but I happen to be more familiar with the southwest, are inundated now with developers. There's 200 houses going up in East Devon. 4,000 people marched in East Devon about 7 weeks ago. Don't know whether you read about it. It wasn't widely reported in the media. 4,000 residents of Sidmouth protested to the district council on the developments. Evercreech, a small village just outside Shepton Mallet, is about to have 90 houses because the developer brought a QC from London who shredded the district council, shredded it. And now there's another developer at Frinton in Devon, 400 houses. It's right across the country. It's a ticking time bomb. And that isn't history, but it is actually policy of Labour government that has brought this about on immigration. Numbers uncontrolled.
I don't quite understand how you've managed to link the need to build housing in our country and indeed the need for affordable housing for young people, especially in your area of the West Country where house prices are so expensive. And I'm going to leave you on the thought that, you know, the values that are so important to us as the Labour Party, that we achieve more together than we do alone, are values which I share by being at the heart of the European Union. And I look forward to Labour playing a role in reforming Europe and into generating a future that we can all be proud of.
You can't change it from within. I want a democratic, elected government in Westminster that is only accountable to the UK electorate.
Thanks there to Colin McNamee and Darren Jones.
For those of you who are unhappy about the prospect of a new wave of immigrants flooding the country next year, you can sign an e-petition.
So we have with us in the studio Jeremy Clark, who's from the Bristol Stop the War Coalition. And Jeremy's going to be talking to us about the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Welcome, Jeremy.
I'm here to talk about the 10th anniversary, March the 20th. On that day, Bristol Stop the War, in order to mark the anniversary, we'll read the names of the 179 British soldiers who died, but also, importantly, a small sample of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died in the invasion. Obviously, what's been evident in the years since the invasion is that we were told lies to get to Britain to join the invasion of Iraq. We were told that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which were threatening not only other states in the region, but within 45 minutes, we were told, they could be launched against Britain and our interests in the region. This was obviously not true, and many people said it wasn't true at the time. Hans Blix, who was the chief UN weapons inspector, said it wasn't true. But despite that fact, the Americans and British concentrated on what was obviously fabricated intelligence to present a case to go to war. And despite the fact that millions of people throughout the world were opposed to this war, they went ahead and invaded Iraq.
So 10 years ago, Tony Blair was our Prime Minister, yeah. And I'm sure quite a few of us can remember some very sketchy shots of some infrared that were supposed to show some weapons of mass destruction. But majority of the people who live in the UK very much were against the UK going to war. That's the case, isn't it?
Well, I think at the time, there were huge demonstrations, as I say, around the world. And in London on the 15th of February 2003, there were probably 1.5 to 2 million people marching in the streets. And Hyde Park was packed with people calling for Britain not to join the invasion. Despite that, we went ahead. Blair had told George Bush that Britain would join the invasion, and they did so, despite the fact that 139 MPs voted against the invasion. I think in terms of public opinion, as measured through opinion polls, it was probably 50-50 split, but there was nowhere near convincing majority in favour of Britain joining the invasion of Iraq.
And there was no real measure of the public, an actual measure of the public's opinion either. Foreign policy that was pushed through. And how legal was that?
Well, the invasion was not approved in advance by the United Nations. The Americans and Britain failed to get a resolution through the United Nations proving the invasion. It was declared as illegal by Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General of the United Nations, and also by Lord Bingham, who was a senior law lord. We've been unable to see the legal advice which the government had because Tony Blair has refused to let us see the advice he got as to whether it was legal or not. The suspicion is that he was initially told by his government lawyers it would be illegal, but he insisted on going ahead because he wanted to be on the side of the Americans. And the effect of the invasion has been that, as I say, 179 soldiers were killed, but hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed in that decade. The lowest estimate I've seen is well in excess of 100,000, but there are other estimates, credible estimates, of upwards of 600,000. There was a report in the Lancet which put the estimate at over 600,000. And that's apart from the millions of Iraqis who were refugees. There are still 1 million refugees not able to return to their homes in Iraq. And in a decade before the invasion, when there were sanctions imposed on Iraq at the behest of the Americans, 500,000 people died in Iraq. And when this figure was put to Madeleine Albright, who was the US Secretary of State at the time, she described it as a price worth paying, which is fairly shocking, really.
In humanist terms, it certainly is. And the deaths that happened during the war, obviously that's quite horrific. But it isn't just the effects during a war, is it, that impacts the society of the countries that are involved?
No. In order to rule Iraq after the invasion, the Americans enhanced the divisions in Iraqi society between different religious groups, the old imperial divide and rule tactic, such that Iraqi society fragmented and is now extremely sectarian and dangerous. 50 people killed in bombs in Iraq on this very day. There was a survey in Iraq done 18 months ago which showed that 2/3 of Iraqis think that their lives are as bad or worse than when Saddam Hussein was in power. There are whole areas of Iraq which have limited water supply and power supplies because the infrastructure was destroyed in the war and has never been repaired.
To say that 2/3 of the Iraqis do not perceive that anything has improved in their lives, that's pretty damning. And I understand that the effect of the weaponry used has been significant.
The health of Iraqis has deteriorated immensely in the last 10 years. I read somewhere it had gone back 60 years, the health of Iraqis. Two problems which directly attributable to the effects of the war. The large increase in rate of abnormal births and cancers, which have been caused by the use of uranium and other toxic weapons.
It's absolutely incredible, it really is. And I don't think that's well known.
It's not spread in the media at all. It's not just in Iraq that is a problem, because many of these contaminants are windborne. Then in surrounding countries that there are similar problems.
Absolutely incredible. It really is. The Bristol Stop the War Coalition, I take it that the issue of the Iraq War isn't the only issue that you cover.
Absolutely not. We were established in 2001 when the USA was threatening to invade Afghanistan, as our aim is to campaign against what was known as against the war in terror in general and all its manifestations. So whilst we oppose the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq, we're also opposed to intervention in places like Libya and Syria, where the Americans and Britain and others are all too happy to lecture these countries on how they should be ruled. When the USA and Britain have brought a decade of death and destruction, it's somewhat ironic that they now see themselves, or still see themselves, as able to lecture places on how they should run themselves.
Thanks, Jeremy.
My name's Osman and I'm originally from Iraq.
And you went back this summer?
Yes, I went back.
Can you tell us what's happening?
Well, the fact is what's happening is absolutely very bad. People suffering, injustice, no human rights, no equalities, no freedom. And the situation in Iraq is very bad. And the people's life has gone really bad and everything is going bad and bad. So a lot of people can't express and go on the street. They want a lot of things to change, but because of the security situation, because of the authority, they can't do what they want. They can't ask for what they want. The authority shoots at them. The authority opens fire at them, imprisons them.
It's not a democracy.
Well, when we talk about democracy, this, what kind of a democracy? If this is a real democracy, it's causing this conflict in Middle East, Asia, and Europe as well. So there's no democracy. There's no democracy, but the authority claims this is a democratic region, this is a democratic place. By the way, Kurdistan is not a country. What I'm trying to say is there's no democracy. What kind of democracy? That's another matter.
Is it worse now than it was when Saddam Hussein was in power or not?
The corruption, the political turmoil is worse. During Saddam Hussein, life of people was much, much better. Since the collapse of Saddam Hussein, the new government of Iraq, the new government of Kurdistan, they do not represent people. They only represent themselves. They have created militia groups, and the system they have is based on militias. There is one thing I really want to point out. It's about crude oil. When I was there, people were queuing to get oil barrel. And the whole place, the whole region, the whole country of Iraq is oil. But I went to some place that is a border between Iran and Iraq, and I saw many tanks filled of oil, and they were just sending it and selling it to Iran. So people are suffering of the basic things. For example, the people can't get enough fuel. This is a big problem, and it's a system that you cannot criticize. The system, if you criticize today, you will be arrested tomorrow, or even be tortured, or the worst thing can happen to you, kill.
So do you think Libya's going to go the same way?
This is something Libya, in terms of Libya, the West and the United States both trying to engage democracy or implement democracy in Libya, Middle East as a whole. But this is also a big matter. The future of Libya, in my opinion, is unknown. This is what happened in Iraq. We go there and to change the regime. But this time is different with Libya. They say we go there just to prevent no-fly zones. They could not, because they experienced a bad time with Iraq. They have left Iraq with no victory, but the life is gone. Life of people have gone worse, and now I would say millions of people have been killed. I'm scared if Libya and some other places face the same situation. The key points about Libya, that the system and the outsiders, the West and the United States involved in this operation, is because of Libya. For example, when the conflict began in Libya, the fuel prices rose in Britain and in the whole world. It caused a bad experience for the system.
I noticed on the radio that as soon as Libya fell, they were already talking about business people going in to set up contracts. So they're already eyeing up the gold.
The similar or the same, I would say, the same method that they've used in Iraq. For example, in Iraq, they've made a contract with some oil companies like Shell, BP's and some other companies. What they did was they made a contract for the next 30 or 50 years. I'm not sure, but there was something going on. And a friend of mine mentioned to me last week, he said there is a great meeting about the how to promote the oil or petroleum in Iraq to make further contract. And I asked him, what do you mean? He was very happy about this. He said, I'm very happy because the Kurds are getting on their way and blah, blah. But I'm sure he was not aware about the political situation, the lifestyle of the people, the lifestyle of innocent people. You know, people are suffering. And it's happening the same thing. If it's not the same, it's very, very similar.
In Libya?
In Libya, yes. Libya is rich with a small population of about 6 million or over, with a great productive soil. For example, it's got too much oil. I was reading a book about why the West rule the world. It's a very interesting book. Whoever will take power in Libya will be pretty much involved or engaged with the West. When the conflict began in Libya, those people who always wanted to fall down the regime of Gaddafi have been in the whole Europe. Yes, I mean, whoever will take the power will lead the country in the next, I don't know, few months or the next generation. They will be very much involved with the West, with the United States in particular.
It's like colonialization under a different label.
I would say this is a kind of a modern colonization. They used to talk about imperialism, but this is a modern imperialism. But I mean, in my opinion, imperialism is ended, but this is a capitalism, and a capitalism is capable of doing anything to sustain itself, to undermine the people, the demands of people. It's really something we have to wait and see what will happen. Bush always talks about terrorism, terrorism and terrorism. What about the killing of million people in Iraq? Your airstrikes, your soldiers killed innocent people. What kind of action? Is this really, do you call this freedom? What do you call this? Is that not a terrorist activities? What is it? Yeah. Bush, he failed his foreign policy. He meant to reach a greater place, to create Iraq for a greater place, but I think the situation is deteriorating because of the invasion, because of what's going on in Iraq. One thing I really want to mention, this is a problem. Iraq has gone to a civil war. A civil war is a very segregated society now. I'm originally from that country. I was here and then I realized there are more Shias than Sunnis. By the way, I'm an atheist, but what I'm trying to say is this is something you can never see Iraq. I'm not, when I say you can never see Iraq, it doesn't mean Saddam was a great person. But Saddam Hussein was okay.
He knew the problems because he was from the country.
The problem with the West and US is that, in my opinion, they had very little or limited experience about tribalism. The Middle East is very tribal. And these tribes were controlled by Saddam Hussein in Iraq during his power. For example, Libya society is based on tribe. He had a very big and massive tribe. So because of that, he was very powerful and he ruled the country for 42 years. They had not experienced about the situation, the tribalism. So that's what happened in Iraq. And the West didn't have any good knowledge about the situation. They knew there were tribes, but they didn't have information about this or knowledge. Religion creates a lot of problems, anxiety, and antagonism among the society in Iraq and Middle East in particular. So this is a big problem.
Did the British soldiers kill a lot of people in Iraq?
Not something I can't really say. The aim was to liberate Iraq. Iraq, everyone is involved, even though if you're not practically kill someone, but you should be done for a onslaught of getting involved, though you had some connections still.
If innocent people have been killed, will the perpetrators be taken to court?
There's not a law that can really show equality or show something that, yes, there is a law and that people goes to jail because even though he is a politician or if he's in a political power in government, there are a lot of corruption about the system. There are a lot of problems.
Run from the dark.
So we have Chris Waller, photographer, with us. Chris, you're going to be speaking to us about Swaddling Coat and its dialect, which I have to say means nothing to me. So I am absolutely fascinated to know in photographical terms what that means and what it means to you as well.
Well, I'm a sort of immigrant to Bristol. I came to Bristol 35 years ago from this strange little town in South Derbyshire, a place called Swaddling Coat. Known as Swad to its residents because it's not worth the last two syllables. I really shouldn't have said that because I've upset everybody that lives in Swaddling Coat. Let me go back to the time when I was growing up in the late 50s, early 60s in Swaddling Coat. It was a classic 19th century industrial town. Coal mines, brickyards, potteries, boiler yards, railways, all the muck and filth of old-fashioned industries. The place has a smell about it. When I think of Swaddling Coat, what I think of is the smell, that sulphurous smell of coal smoke coming out of the factories. And it was there that I first became involved in photography, because it was there that I first took photographs of the last days of the railway. Swaddling Coat is one of those places that it's famous for being ugly. One of its other sons, Rennie Cutforth, the late Rennie Cutforth, the BBC journalist, he came from Swaddling Coat and he described it as so ugly that it made you laugh. And it really was, because the area had been extensively mined for coal and clay. There were gaping great holes in the ground, half a mile across, from which coal and clay had been extracted. And between them were the roads and the railways, and these little 24-inch gauge, 23.5-inch gauge tramways where coal and clay was hauled up out of the quarries. So this whole mess, it looked like a lunar landscape, and it was covered in a pall of smoke and dust most of the time. Swaddling Coat had this strange dialect, and it's a dialect which one can only hear spoken in probably about 6 square miles. And it owes its origins mainly to the days of the Danish conquest of Britain, because the Danes had a capital in Repton, and they populated the area quite densely. And strangely enough, right through up to this century, one can hear in the local dialect the remnants of the Danish language. For instance, if you go back to my grandmother's generation, when she was speaking, she wouldn't say, "you make," but she would say, "you mekken." She didn't say, "you come," but "you kommen." You can hear that Germanic Danish root in the language. And it's odd when I go back there and I hear this language now, I hear this dialect now, it seems sort of at once very familiar to me, and yet, since I've lived here now for 35 years, it also seems strangely foreign to me. And it does make me laugh when I hear the people speak, and I think, oh yes, I remember that as a childhood. The dialect it sounds quite harsh, and people used to have these shouted conversations across the road, and they'd speak in short bursts. It was an industrial town, people hadn't got a lot of time, so their conversations were short and sharp, and you would hear these strange bursts in this strange dialect as people exchange pleasantries, you know.
Is it still very prevalent, or have you seen it ebb as the years go on?
It has declined over the last couple of decades, I suppose, because of the influence of television and radio and what have you. You know, the outside world is sort of imposing itself on the area, and so the dialect is gradually fading, and it is more and more difficult to find people who do speak the dialect, who are still using the dialect words and using the strange sort of inversions of vowel sounds that you find in that. It's strange, people in that area don't talk about boiling water, but they talk about biling waiter. They don't talk about green paint, but grain paint. And a nail is what you hammer into wood, whereas a nail is what you do when you get down on your knees.
Well, I think that just sounds wonderful, and thank you so much. Back from India, Tim Burrows, our resident soundscape artist and poet. Tim, it's wonderful to have you back. How was India, and what did you do in your journeys?
I was fantastic. I found people in the south really, really friendly, made a lot of friends there. Initially went on an art trail, which is called a sketchbook tour of South India with a group of West Country mainly artists, led by Maxine Relton, who's a professional artist friend. So we went down to the south, flew into Trivandrum, went across to the SCAD project, which is, we stayed at a social project, which is a development project for local Tamil people, especially trying to get kids training, working with gypsy children, working with kids with learning difficulties, that sort of thing.
So this is a project set up for the benefit of teaching children, but also other people about creative arts, is that right?
It's mainly to help develop skills for kids, I guess, but it was started by an Indian Catholic priest who decided he wanted to work directly with people with the problems in the areas, and now it uses microeconomics and develops a lot of projects, and it gets people to be self-funding, which is great. By staying in the project, we're staying on the campus near Tiernavelli. Yeah, so we went to meet a lot of the kids. I played some music at a couple of the schools, and so it was kind of an educational side to the trip, really. Felt good to be doing something which was, because there's obviously a lot of development needed, and there's a lot of very marginalised people all over India.
Particularly in the south. These were children who weren't necessarily brought up with any great education. What kind of things did you do with them?
Well, we visited, so the usual lessons were going on. They were, I guess we call them primary school lessons. They sang us a song, but their parents were there, their mums selling jewellery and stuff. And we went to a health project as well, which works with people with leprosy and recovering from leprosy and things. Around that, we did sketched in villages, sketched temples, visited temples, went to Madurai, where there's a massive, if you like, very old temple. It's one of the most visited sites in India. Again, took a load of photos. I've got a load of photos on Facebook. And I, when the rest went home, I went to stay in Kochi and ended up learning some sitar and bringing back a sitar and having an endless discussion about the differences between the Indian music system and the Western music system, because obviously the Indian music system is a lot older. So, yes, I'm just trying to learn a little bit of sitar. So. 20 strings. It was great fun bringing a guitar and a sitar and a bag back through two flights and customs. And I'd like to thank my friends at the Katakali Centre in Fort Kochi for helping me get the sitar and doing lessons and putting on loads of good music and Katakali dancing, which is all that heavily made-up dance routine. So, yeah, I've had a lovely trip, but managed to do some things, which feels better than kind of, I'm not a real sit-on-the-beach person.
Have you found it quite inspiring for your own art and your own writing?
I find it a very spiritual place, and started to do some yoga again, which I learnt last time I was in India, and I think it brings those things out. It's a very old part of the world that's got so much history and culture that you... It seeps in, and there's a lot of change going on there with the old ways being challenged by the new prosperity and things. And I think there's signs of there being a big divide between the rural parts and the kind of more city and urban-based populations. I was reading some William Dalrymple writings, and he's very good on that, about, writing about the changes going on in India, and that some of the crafts and traditions are going to be lost because people are becoming urbanised and life is changing. I love India, and I'll go back again and hope to continue my sitar lesson. It's kind of like the sound of India. I think everyone thinks of that because you get the sympathetic things that warble in the background. And when I can play something, I might bring it down. And
I was going to ask you.
But I have to sit on the floor because you don't hold it like a guitar. So the part of the lesson was how to fold my legs down so I could lean on it with one arm to support it and then play. And I think I was driving some people mad when I was staying in a small hostel hotel place, and the other residents wondering what the hell was going on because there's this.
Well, listening to someone learn to play guitar is not the most comfortable thing.
Well, like,
so
that's fine, but sitar is a different beast.
Wow, that sounds fantastic.
And thanks to Emirates, for they were really good with instruments. I think they escorted instruments onto the plane and off the plane. So
treat them with due reverence then. So the name of the project that you were getting involved with, that was called
SCAD. The SCAD project, yeah, so it's in Tamil Nadu. You can go online and it's got a website. And hopefully we've got a friend, Mr. Charles, coming over, who's one of the development workers, who's going to be here in September because he comes and visits Bristol. So we'll hopefully have him down.
Wonderful.
To tell you face to face.
Well, thank you very much, Tim, for talking to us about your amazing adventures in India.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
The supermarkets, mainly the Big Four, are still dishing out free plastic bags to shoppers, despite recommendations that the practice should cease and plastic bags should be paid for to cut down on pollution. The argument is that they would get too much flack from the customer if they took away the free bags. But Aldi and Lidl charge 10 pence per bag without any problems. The next song, recorded some years ago, is a lament to the plastic bag.
My name is Gaspar, and I'm going to sing a song about a plastic bag. Oh, plastic bag, you were always there to help me bear my heavy load. Long shopping miles and dusty roads, so very light and yet so strong. But now they say you'll soon be gone. I don't know how I'll carry on. Oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag. I have seen the ice melting on TV. I've seen new deserts in the rising sea. I've eaten carrots devoid of taste. I've seen mountains of human waste. I've felt the guilt, I have felt the shame, but I know not why you should get the blame. Oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag. It's such a fad to do your shopping with a cotton bag. When you get to the till, you usually find you've left the freaking thing behind. And wicker baskets, they don't belong in supermarkets, they just look wrong. Oh, plastic bag, no plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag. I have met people who drive their car even though they're not going very far, who turn their heating up all day long instead of putting some long johns on. I've seen cheap flights that chop down trees, but you are no worse than any of these. Oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag. I recall the days when I'd use you in so many ways, to cover my bike seat, protect my shoes, to hold my rubbish, my doggy poos. You've been my friend all along, but now you're going, I can't go on. Oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag, oh, plastic bag.
The Lament of the Plastic Bag there, composed by Gaspar. And of course, charges for plastic bags are mandatory in both Wales and Ireland. Why aren't they mandatory here?
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. The producer, Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Ball.
And it's goodbye from me, James Melia.
Until next week, goodbye.